Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and in the studio this week, I am extremely excited, and not just because Rory K. Smith isn't here, but because in addition to the very excellent Julian Lawrence and to Matt Hughes, who trekked in all the way from Mortlake, Richmond, or whatever posh part of West London he's gone undercover in, we are joined in a rare studio appearance in the flesh by George Culkin, the gold standard, as most people refer to him. Coming up, we'll be talking relegation, plus rounding up the action from what was a rather lame weekend of football at the top end of the table. I guess we have to start with events at Old Trafford.
Well, that is a wonderful pass out towards Theo Walcott now. What damage can he do from here? Taking on Blackett. Oh, it's in. It's looped up off the Manchester United substitute and beaten Victor Valdez. Arsenal are back on level terms.
The biggest team in the universe, United against Arsenal, who has long-standing rivalry and blah, blah, blah. I thought this game was kind of lame and boring. I think the first booking was an injury time. It was really rather irrelevant to anything. I like to think we could maybe throw it forward, as the kids say, unless somebody has anything to say about this game, about actually what happened on the pitch. Anything interesting?
It's a dissection of ordinariness. I think that's it. And I mean, I'm still quite surprised by that every time I see Man United, about just how ordinary they are. I mean, it's a relative concept, and it's even more relative based on the fact that I watch North East football. But I would always look forward to seeing Man United in particular, because the swagger, the talent, you know, all that sort of stuff. And they are ordinary. I mean, they've become ordinary.
You found a kindred spirit here, Julien. Julien, you'll know, invited the ire and ridicule of Twitter by referring to one Aloysius van Gaal as a fraud earlier this season. I don't know, you're not quite going that far, are you?
I'm not well qualified enough to go that far, I don't think.
Right. And Ashley Young is the man of the match, says it all.
He's the player of the season.
Player of the season.
For Man United, he's been fantastic, which I'm being slightly facetious, but he has improved a lot, but it shows how far United have fallen when they're looking to Young and Fellaini as their top men, and they're making Chris Smalling their captain.
I mean, I think overall, looking at both those games yesterday, the thing that struck me was that the contest for second place next season might be interesting. But and I know there's always a temptation to sort of anoint, if one team wins and wins well, there's a temptation to kind of anoint them automatically for the season afterwards. But I think Chelsea just look so, in comparison, just look so solid, so strong, and have a sense of purpose. And I think there are huge question marks about the three teams below.
Okay, well, we'll preview next season at the start of next season, George.
You said throw it forward.
You did say throw it forward.
I mean, throw it forward into some sort of future 3 months.
To next week.
No, in the immediate, David De Gea, while you guys are all like slobbering all over Fellaini and Young, David De Gea has been probably definitely their best player. And I would imagine that if David De Gea hadn't been there, and the Danish reserve goalkeeper, whose name I've forgotten because I choose to forget, or Victor Valdez had been in goal this season, they might not be in the Champions League next year. And yet David De Gea has 1 year left on his contract. The way Van Gaal, I was really struck by the way Van Gaal spoke about him after the match, because he was kind of like, yeah, well, you know, he's Spanish, he's a Spanish girlfriend. It sounded to me like somebody who's certainly resigned, either resigned to losing De Gea or wants people to think he's resigned to losing De Gea. And I suppose it's possible that tomorrow United will come out and be like, ha-ha, we fooled you, look, he just signed a 5-year deal. But why are they so rubbish that they didn't sort this out when he had 2 years left on his contract, which is when sane clubs go and do their business. Is this another stick we can beat Woodward with?
In this case, I'm not sure it is, really.
Why not? Come on. I want to blame everything on Ed.
The De Gea Madrid link has been rumbling for a long, long time. He's known that. United have known that. The contract from United's been on the table all season, and he's not signed it because he wants to go to Real Madrid. It's obvious. Iker Casillas is 35. He's clearly on the way out. He should have been dropped by Spain years ago.
But the dude comes to this country, right? Yeah. Has slightly difficult stuff, difficult start. And then you could tell by the end of the second season that he was the real deal, right? And that was the time to sit him down and say, listen, you have 2 years left. You're 22 years old, or however old he was at the time, I think 22. At the time, there was no vacancy at Real Madrid or potential vacancy at Real Madrid. Iker Casillas was not 35. I would have thought a bit of foresight would have mandated, like, let's sit this guy down, let's lock him up. He's got 2 years left, and let's go and do it now.
They tried last summer, and he didn't want to sign the contract. So ultimately, other than offering him 400 grand a week, what can they do? I think there's certain transfers that you can't blame the selling club for. Ronaldo to Real Madrid is one. Cesc to Barcelona is another. Ultimately, these guys are going to want to go home and play. How can you stop them?
Even if he had another 10 years on his contract, I think he would have gone anywhere. I don't think it's the length of the contract and when they didn't renew it, why, and this and that. I think even if he had signed a new one 2 years ago and still had three or 4 years on his contract, I think
if he'd signed a new contract, you would be getting market value for him.
Yeah, it'd be more difficult for Madrid to get him probably, but I still think that he would go anywhere.
We saw this last summer, right? Toni Kroos, pretty good player, World Cup winner, 1 year left on his contract. And he ends up costing substantially less than Adam Lallana, right? Who's older and nowhere near as good. That's what happens when you have a year left on your contract. This is what I don't understand is, I mean, even if they understood that he was going to go, surely the thing to do would be to speak to him and say, listen, let's extend you, let's put in a clause, which is kind of what they did with Cristiano, right?
Right. Yeah, you're right, but none of this is Louis van Gaal's fault. Maybe he's relaxed because he's got a solution.
No, you mentioned Louis van Gaal. I wouldn't dare to criticize Louis van Gaal. It's obviously not his fault he got here, but there were other people at Manchester United before him who were looking after contracts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, whether this happened in the transition from Gil to Woodward, I think this is a major boo-boo.
I think that's a reasonable point. I mean, there are intricacies perhaps to it, that, and obviously personal, you know, size of it. If he wants to go back to Spain, then that's kind of understandable. I mean, to me, the sad thing is that it would mean losing a world-class player, and there aren't enough of those in the Premier League to sort of be blasé about. And I do think that would leave, I think you made a very good point in saying that without De Gea, they wouldn't have finished where they are. And, you know, there are decent goalkeepers around, but I don't think there are that many that you can kind of be relaxed about that.
But if Man United are smart, they go out tomorrow and say, Chelsea, there's 15 million, we want Pedicek. He's 2 years younger than Van der Sar was when he signed for United, and he gave them 5 great years. So there are goalkeepers out there that can be bought. They just have to be decisive and move. Because Arsenal will mess around all summer, and Wenger will go, I'm not sure, maybe. Oh, we'll give Ospina another chance. The door is open for United to get a check if they want him.
Lloris?
Well, Lloris would be a lot more expensive, obviously.
Yeah, it would be more, but he's younger. And,
yeah.
If Real Madrid don't change their manager, and it's a big if, you have a situation where you have a Gareth Bale who's... I think the abuse he's getting is nowhere near as bad as some people here make it out to be, but obviously...
I was there Wednesday. It was pretty ugly.
Well, his game was pretty ugly on Wednesday.
He was better than Ronaldo. Ronaldo just wasn't there second half.
I agree.
Bale missed some chances, but he was there.
He tried. No, really. Cristiano didn't try.
I think that
Isco was terrible.
Some teams can carry two passengers if they've got nasty holding midfielders who run around like maniacs. Real Madrid don't have that, and so they can't carry two passengers off the ball. But I'm wondering, might it be a deal that helps everybody if you send Bale to Manchester and you send De Gea and Di Maria the other way? And obviously there'd be money changing hands. And
it's just very hard to agree on a valuation for all those three different players, isn't it? Di Maria was £60 million last summer. He's not had a great season. He's not in the team. Van Gaal's questioned his attitude. So what is he worth now? Is he worth 40? Is he worth 50? How do you do it?
Well, we can put a valuation on De Gea, right? Using Toni Kroos as a benchmark. They're roughly the same age. De Gea makes more than what Kroos made before. Kroos went for about $22 million. If you say you put $25 million on De Gea, right? Bale's probably slightly tough to judge as well how much he's worth, because obviously he's older than he was when... he went over there. He cost $80 million. Is Bale straight up for Di Maria and De Gea. Is that a fair deal?
It's a good deal for Man United. I'm not sure it's a fair deal. I think Real Madrid wants some money thrown in. Yeah.
Talking about Arsenal for a second, since the joke's been made that, you know, they're always kind of like next year's team. And I look at this rationally and say, yeah, they are next year's team because they have all these players who are on the up and they're approaching maturity. And why shouldn't Arsenal fans be excited?
I think they're more balanced than the other two teams that we're talking about. You know, there is always this sense that they're in football's waiting room and it's been, when does a trophy come? When does the big signing happen? When do they beat big teams?
Now, they win a trophy by the end of the month.
Yeah, right? and they did it last season, of course, as well. And they've bought the big player. I'm still not sure that they quite have what it takes. But I mean, yeah, I think if they do end this season third and with the FA Cup again, there is a sense that something's been broken that they can take it forward. Whether they've got enough to challenge Chelsea yet, I would doubt personally.
Okay, let's do some sexual role play now, okay? You're Dick.
Thank God.
Law. And you're Arsene Wenger, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Have a conversation amongst yourselves for the next 45 seconds and decide what your biggest priority is this summer.
Dick, I need a defensive midfielder. What have your team of scouts and, you know, what do you have for me?
Dick Law does not have a Yorkshire accent, so I expect you to do this properly.
I can't really do American, I'm afraid. maybe you can.
No, that's fine. Just let's suspend disbelief. Go ahead.
Well, it's up to you. As everything at this club, Arsene, it's up to you. I keep giving you targets, you keep being indecisive.
What have you been doing, Dick, the last 6 months? I told you to scout for a defensive midfielder. I need someone more than Coughlin.
I signed Coughlin's contract extension. I think Schneiderlin is likely to be a target, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I think he wants more experience though in that role. Sorry, we've stopped the sexual role play. Sorry.
Yeah, it's the worst sexual role play that I've ever witnessed. Not that I've witnessed any.
Are you sure? Yeah, maybe more experience.
Experienced defensive midfielder? How about
Arteta? It's
like a new signing.
The problem with Schneiderlin though, he's never played Champions League or even Europa League. And I think Wenger sees that as a sort of an issue somehow of, is he good enough? What kind of level is he good at? Even with France, he's never been that great. So the guy's never played in Europe, never really been good with on international level. So like, how do you know if he will really bring you add value to your squads? You know, it's the same with Kondogbia at Monaco. I don't think he's really sure if he's really the...
He was excellent
good
against Arsenal.
He was really
and
good.
And Juventus, actually.
But I've seen him this season where he was absolutely dreadful.
Yeah.
Really, and in Ligue 1 as well, which is like, come on. The issue, though, would be the goalkeeper and the striker, because I really believe he's not going to buy a goalkeeper or a striker in the summer.
Sigurdsson to take the corner. Swansea will certainly feel that they deserve an equaliser. Swung in towards Fernandes. What a save. An absolutely stunning stop from Joe Hart. Denying Fernandes, Swansea's third goal. Saves simply do not get any better than this.
Moving on to more interesting clubs, Swansea and Man City, this game finished, was it 4-2? This shows you how interesting and interested I was in what happened yesterday. Again, anybody have anything interesting to say about this game? Do we care about Boney not celebrating? Anybody want to make a joke about Yaya Toure and the stupid birthday cake? Or has that been all horses we've beaten to death?
Not really, but for a dead game, it was great to watch.
You like goalkeeping errors, yeah?
Well,
Fabianski,
very
Fabianski doing the seaman, yeah.
For a game with very little on it, it was pretty entertaining. And City, I remember being here a month ago and we talked about Wood City finished top four, where Pellegrini gets sacked. I think that he's done enough to keep his job, I suspect.
Why is he keeping his job?
Because there's no obvious man to replace him, and they have the Pep obsession, and their hope is that in a year Pep will be available and he will solve all their problems. Whether that happens or not is open to debate. But Pellegrini, he's won the league and he's probably going to finish second. So
it will be harsh.
It will be harsh to second.
It will really be harsh.
Yeah, but,
I mean,
okay, this is what I don't understand about you people. By you people, I mean the media. He had won the league before. He was going to finish second before. And yet it seemed like he was a spent force, and why is he playing 4-4-2, and all this other crap that people, all the accusations that people throw at the man. Now all of a sudden, because you figured out the Pep Guardiola story to City probably isn't right, and because Jurgen Klopp's going to go somewhere else, all of a sudden like they can't come up with somebody better? They've all changed their minds?
No, if you can get the man you want, then there's an argument to get rid of him. But if the alternative is taking a chance on Patrick Vieira, which basically seems to be plan B, then why take that risk? Pellegrini has shown that he can win trophies, and even in a bad season, they can finish second. When they get rid of Toure, get a more balanced squad, sort the midfield out in the summer, they should be able to kick on. They've still got some very, very, very good players. If Aguero had been fit all season, it might have been slightly different. And if other players had performed, if Kompany had been fit, there's lots of ifs, buts and maybes. But given there is no alternative, and given their obvious desire to get Guardiola in the long term remains there, it would seem odd just to sort of sack Pellegrini on a whim. And they're happy that I think he's stabilised things, because a month ago it looked like they were sinking.
He's made mistakes, but you know, a lot of managers make mistakes, and I think the 4-4-2 when he played it, you know, a certain part of the season, I think was a mistake.
Let the record reflect, I'm not having a go at Pellegrini. In fact, I was a person who said that he should probably stay, given also the financial fair play restrictions on the one hand will be lifted if they meet the requirements of the settlement, but on the other hand, you know, they still need to meet the other parameters, which are getting increasingly tighter and I think are tough to do for a club like Manchester City, at least in the short term. George, is this kind of an example of knee-jerkism about how everybody wanted this guy out, and or a lot of people in the media wanted these guys out, certainly the punditocracy? And then, as Julian says, he wins a couple games against a couple of irrelevant games against irrelevant teams late in the season, and all of a sudden, yeah, well, why not? Let's keep him. He won the league.
I don't know. I mean, I think perceptions change, don't they? And it depends on circumstances. I mean, you know, they've underachieved. I mean, I think you have to say that they've underachieved. If you look at the squad they've got and, you know, the kind of riches in attack, I mean, I think they have underachieved. They haven't been as good as they should be. So the first kind of point of call is to look at the manager and then, you know, think about that. And Champions League was obviously, is obviously sort of an obsession there. And, you know, there are kind of deep issues within their squad. Whether it's Yaya Touré, whether it's Milner, whether it's others, and it's an ageing squad, is all of that Pellegrini's fault? You know, I don't know. I mean, I would say, you know, I would always want to give the manager another chance and to give the manager a chance to build something. You know, again, yeah, what options, you know, what options did they have, and how does that fit in with the culture of what they're trying to build?
Well, that's kind of the thing. I mean, we talk about the culture, what they're trying to build, but this is a squad where every single player will be 28 or every single relevant player will be 28 or older next season, except for Mangala, who's been terrible, and Aguero, who's going to be 27. They have this homegrown player requirement where they've got people like Clichy help them fill the quota, but obviously they're going to lose Milner, they're going to lose Frank Lampard Jr. They need to replace these guys. Buying English players is very expensive if you want to buy good ones. I mean, have they really, and everybody's getting older, have they really thought this through?
You were talking earlier about clubs sleepwalking into contract problems. I found it astonishing James Milner will leave on a free, probably go to Liverpool for slightly more money. Why, he's probably been their most, other than Aguero, consistent player all season. He'll play in every position. He's got the best attitude of any professional I've ever encountered. Why they didn't swap this out and give him the money he wanted 12 months ago is I find amazing.
Think, though, that if Real Madrid make the big mistake of sacking Carlo Ancelotti, if I was City, I would get Carlo Ancelotti every single day and tell Pellegrini to go back to Chile.
Go back to Chile?
Come on, go back. Because I think Carlo would be amazing.
Do you have to add that bit? I mean, can you not go somewhere else?
I think he probably misses a bit Chile. From home, so he can go. He can have a few vacation in Chile if he wants. But I think Carlo, I really think Carlo, I don't buy into the let's wait another year for Pep, this and that, unless there's a secret agreement that we don't know about. But if Carlo is free, I'm a big fan, obviously, but I would go for Carlo every single day.
There's no guarantee Pep would come.
Exactly.
Anyway, I mean, it's always talked about, you know, project and history and things, and everyone thought that Arsenal or Man United were the most obvious fits for him. Everyone assumes that Soriano and Bergestan are his best friends, but we don't really know that. Cause
not so sure.
Yeah,
it's just a big club like that can't just, you know, it's like you want a house and you think, oh yeah, maybe I like this house, maybe they're going to sell it in a year, you know, maybe I can. How can a club like City can just do everything around the chance maybe that they could get Pep when he's gone? Come on, I think it's ridiculous.
Also, like I said, also if they get Pep, they'll get a bunch of old players on huge contracts, which make them nearly impossible to sell. That's the other thing. This whole age profiling of the squad, the way this has been built, has been absolutely terrible. And while I really loved Chiqui Beguiristain as a player, I was kind of ho-hum about him as a director of football at Barcelona, because I distinctly remember Chigrinsky and Karasin and people like that. I think he's done an absolutely terrible job right now in managing this. And you mentioned the Milner thing. You look at the age profiles of the players. you look at the way they just kind of gave Nastasic away, which, you know, okay, fine, Pellegrini doesn't like him, but a lot of really good football people who are more clever than Pellegrini probably, or have won more, saw value in him, and you just kind of said, like, oh, yeah, here, we don't need you, you know.
Nasri, a new contract.
Nasri, a new contract. That's right.
So many things, like...
City have obviously had to prime their squad to do what they want to do, I mean, and that's fair enough, but then you look at kind of what's happened at Chelsea, albeit over a slightly longer period. You know, there is always that criticism of them that young players don't come through the system, but those young players do go out on loan. You know, I've seen a fair bit of Patrick Bamford, for example, this season. They got rid of sold Lukaku for a hell of a lot of money last summer. They are bringing resource back into the club, and they have, you know, they've had that benefit, and I don't think City have got the hang of that bit yet.
Right, enough of this. Let's get to the more exciting bit about the Premier League, which is the relegation battle, which in fact could have been more exciting, but then, as often happens late in the season, the bad teams who are right near the bottom all start winning until they don't need to win again. See Aston Villa. And then the teams that we thought were just mediocre start losing continuously, like Newcastle. And it's basically, I guess there is a scenario where Sunderland can get relegated, but I don't think anybody wants to debate that possibility, because surely it can't happen, right?
Well, I don't know. Why? Why do you say that?
Because they'd have to lose their last two games.
Against us, at Arsenal and at Chelsea.
Right. Chelsea don't need the points. I remember Chelsea playing Bolton on the last day of the season years ago. This is the other thing.
Yeah, but they're playing Sunderland, who aren't very good at football.
No, but it's Dick Advocaat, and really, you think Sunderland can go down?
Well, I mean, I think they're 12-1 outsiders of the three of them.
If God were to appear to you and said, like, George, I'm going to make one of these three teams go down, who do you want to go down?
Well, I mean, as a strictly neutral observer of these things,
who is most deserving of going down?
Well, I would say that at the moment, well, whoever goes down is deserving to go down. I mean, in terms of utter witlessness and utter appallingness of football, then I'm going to say Newcastle, because they have ceased to be a football club in any meaningful sense of the word. I mean, and that brings me pain to say that, but I mean, it's a disgusting football club at the minute. It's unpleasant to be around. They've let this, and it's completely self-inflicted, they've let this season drift. You know, Alan Pardew leaving this 5-week, whatever it was.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Limbo while they looked at other managers, then giving it to the bloke who already had it, and everything has tailed off from that position. They were 11th as recently as February, March even. Like, you know, it's not just a failure of football, although it's a huge failure of football. It's a failure of model. It's a failure of planning. It's a failure of, you know, it's a failure of emotion, in the sense that it's become a football club completely divorced from its own followers. It's divorced from the media.
Owner, so.
It's divorced from the media. It's divorced from the city. It's divorced from institutions. And in the sense of that old-fashioned thing about what we think football should be and should be about, it's stopped being a football club.
Well, here's the part I don't understand. I appreciate Mike Ashley doesn't like talking to the media and so on. And to be fair, he's an owner. Roman Abramovich never speaks to the media either, right? But Roman Abramovich hires people who get his message and these people go and they talk, sometimes on the record, sometimes privately, mostly with Matt, and they kind of tell him the club line. And they tell you at least what the club are thinking, right? What the logic is. Mike Ashley can't be a dunce because he made a lot of money and he didn't just inherit a lot of money. And he's seen the protests and all the stuff that's gone on. I'm assuming there is somebody at Newcastle who tells you what the project is, who tells you what the club are trying to do, whether, I mean, obviously I'm asking you to reveal their sources, but whether privately or publicly. And what do they say? What, you know, when you see this happening, what justification do they bring?
Well, first of all, no, they don't do that. I mean, there has been a complete and utter cessation of relationships with the media. It's a policy. So, I mean, this gets a bit dull, but they've stripped access back to the absolute bare minimum. So, I mean, interestingly, in the last few weeks, I've had a conversation with someone at the top of the club, and that was a kind of fairly extensive conversation.
So they do talk to you.
That has happened, and I think moving forward, there will be a deliberate softening of language, this very cold language, that the corporate language that they use. There will be a softening of that. There's a recognition that's a kind of mistake, and I think they'll re-embrace the FA Cup, having previously said that it wasn't a priority.
Did this person explain to you what their thinking was with Pardew leaving without having a replacement?
Yeah. So
Carver.
So the phrase used to me was, "We would never have sacked Alan Pardew." I mean, they effectively proved that in the autumn anyway. And they, from their perspective, I mean, I don't really want to talk about that from their perspective, but I will. I mean, they brought together a 3-man shortlist, which for various reasons they couldn't get. Any of the, one of them was McLaren, one of them was Remy Gard, the third one I don't know whether it was contractual or moral obligations in terms of McLaren at Derby and things like that. They couldn't do it. They say they wanted someone to come in to put his ideas across, etc., etc., but the point is they failed. And having taken so long to do it, John Carver effectively had, the rug pulled out from underneath him. He'd spoken well about the FA Cup, then they lose horribly at Leicester. Didn't sign anybody in January. They desperately needed a centre-half. They really needed reinforcements up front. And, there is this lack of motivation around the club. Now, players need pushing. I'm not convinced that players at Newcastle get coached. I think they get trained. Nobody improves unless they're incredibly self-motivated, like a Cabaye or a Debussy or,
people who are no longer there, basically.
And it's a failure of model. The players that they bring in don't have a connection to the club. Now, what I mean by that is I'm not saying they buy too many French players or foreign players or whatever. They're not given a reason to believe about Newcastle. No one tells them about the history of the club. No one tells them about why the city is important. And, Carver actually, who's hopelessly out of his depth, did make quite a good point after they lost the fifth consecutive derby to Sunderland. He said there's something in the DNA. And what there is in the DNA is just a lack of understanding about what the club is. But there's no leadership from above that explains that. They think they've got this cold, clinical model that works and it can fit and it... It's a failure of emotion, effectively, is what it is.
We can't talk about Newcastle the whole time, but you probably don't want to, given the situation. But
I just love spreading misery wherever I go.
I wanted to ask about John Carver, because I was predisposed to liking him for a number of reasons, starting with the fact that he's not Alan Pardew, and because, he looked like sort of one of those old guys who kind of hangs around and now he's given a chance and whatever. But then he did something which I thought was absolutely horrendous, which I've only ever seen one other manager do, and that's, of course, Gerard Houllier, with the Williamson incident. Now, to me, that is just so gross and so beyond accusing your player of getting himself sent off when you don't know that that's what he did, and doing it in public afterwards to the media. Any coaching manual, any human relationships with other people. Now, I want to know, did he just kind of, lose it and just blurt out the first thing that came into his head? Or is he really such a bad person that he would go and do this?
I mean, I remember Peter Reid doing it after losing a game at Newcastle with Sunderland, but he didn't last too much longer after. I mean, I've always thought...
Did he single out a specific player say this guy actually got himself sent off on purpose?
No, absolutely. Sorry,
exactly.
No, in that sense, no. But I always think that's the last resort of a manager, is when you turn in your players and you try and get a reaction from them.
But it's almost
different. That was a very extreme.
If you turn against the players as a group, it's one thing, right? Because it's a kind of a cheapo psychological ploy. But if you single out one individual, when you reality is you don't freaking know what was going through this guy's head. You know, if you know for a fact that like Williamson, you know, is high on drugs or worships the devil or had placed a bet together, fine. But you don't know that. And however bad a footballer Williamson might be, he deserves a basic respect where you get your facts before you go and do that. I thought that was appalling. And again, I know had that happened in Italy, and I'm assuming in France as well, you would have had the PFA on this guy's rear end demanding that the club suspend Carver immediately.
Well, he released a statement straight away, didn't he? So you had that extraordinary thing of Carver saying what he said, and then the next day, I think it was, Williamson releasing a statement kind of denying it.
And these guys just work together every day now, everything's fine?
Well, yeah, and he'll, you know, yeah. Yeah, they shook hands and all that. But they, I mean, the club that weekend, the club, which is never feels too far away from being unhinged, felt properly unhinged that weekend. And that was when they went to McLaren and tried to get him in for the last three games.
Is there an element that fans have to take a little bit of responsibility for this mess because of the hounding of Pardew? Because as you say, if Pardew would not have been sacked, if it hadn't, he would still be there probably. If it wasn't for all those protests.
Well, okay.
What's wrong with Pardew?
I think there has been a rewriting of history here. There's a couple of things to remember. First of all, Pardew left voluntarily and Newcastle had shown that they weren't going to sack him. He's left for a pay rise. He's gone to a club where he has a good relationship and, to give him credit, you know, he's done very, very well at somewhere where he's being backed off the pitch, on the pitch, by the people above him. At Newcastle, all those relationships have broken down. Now, Alan Pardew may be the best manager in the world. He'd stop being a good manager at Newcastle. Yeah. And that can happen to anybody.
But I mean,
let's not forget that Newcastle lost six games in a row at the end of last season. Let's not forget that he was the manager that lost four games against Sunderland. And I know it makes it sound like that's a sort of obsession, and I don't kind of mean it to be, but it's sort of how Newcastle and Sunderland judge each other, you know. And he'd become tainted by association with the regime. He had, which again, the same things happened to Carver. Results were poor over the last year, 2 years. There was relegation battle last year. There was the Pellegrini incident on the touchline.
I'm not disputing he's behaved very badly, but what I am suggesting is that Newcastle had a good manager.
No, they didn't.
They
had a decent manager. He'd stopped being an effective manager at Newcastle. Now, whether he would have, overseen this same run of results, of course, is a completely different question. But it's the whole thing. There is sort of no redeeming feature about Newcastle.
The question I just wanted to ask, sorry to go on, is without being seen to have a go at the Newcastle fans, is the situation sort of so toxic that anyone appointed by that regime, can anyone succeed there in the long term? Because anyone who is appointed by that regime has to work with them, therefore they become a proxy for the board.
Yeah, I mean,
how can they win, really?
Yeah, that's exactly. And I think that's when I say it's a failure of model and it's a failure of everything. That's all part of it. And I think when I spoke to the person at the club a couple of weeks ago, I think there was a feeling that this was just before Leicester. I think there was a feeling there that they soften their language, they bring in a new head coach, they bring in lots of new players in the summer, and that solves everything. And I think it's gone way, way, way beyond that. Now, some of that would, if they stay up, some of that will have an effect. But there is one of the very sad things to see in the last few weeks is John Carver is someone who's had a lifetime association with the club. Is a decent fella. I've known him for a long time. Worked with Bobby Robson. Was there for some good times. And you know, he's become tainted by association. He's obviously, you know, he's lost a stone and blah blah blah. I'm not saying I feel kind of sorry for him, but it's a shame that this will be what he's remembered for at Newcastle.
Which players are going to come to this club? Because when before you could see it as a platform, and I think Caballo or Debussy, you know, showed that well. Who's going to come now when you know if you're going to be, you know, reading the papers, even if you played in France or in Spain or in Holland, who would want to come to this mess, you know?
Yeah, and they've tossed away two seasons. I mean, you know, and if you're a fan or if you're a player, particularly if you're a player, that's a big chunk of your life. So they lose Kabay and they don't replace him. They lose Pardew, effectively don't replace him. And it's always this thing where, well, you know, judge us again, we'll do it in the summer. But you can't, you just cannot treat momentum like that. You have to. And they finish fifth and they buy one player, Vernon Anita, who they didn't need. You know, there's this cold model which they think can, you know, they finish fifth, they're not looking to finish fourth the season afterwards, you know. Anyway, I,
painful, but you know.
That, the first question there was actually about Sunderland and about
whether was, yes, you always talk to that.
I would like to say very, very briefly about Sunderland. I mean, they're no better in the sense that they can't keep doing what they've been doing, which is every single season being in the same position, trying to establish something long-term, then jettisoning it. Not enough money to rebuild, so they're scraping around, signing players who aren't good enough, and they're constantly churning. You know, this will eventually bite them.
Right. I'd like to move it to another bad team that's in danger of relegation. It's closer to you, Hughesy, although I guess Hull is the wrong end of Yorkshire, right?
Not even in Yorkshire, if you ask me.
On the whole front, is it as easy as Steve Bruce comes, spends loads of money, goes well for a while, then they freak out because there's no more money to spend because of the Premier League's own financial fair play rule? So he starts buying bad players, wrong players, and just not really being that good. But I looked at whole squad and I was kind of, and the fact that Bruce was in charge and the kind of players he had and Huddleston and all this stuff, and they don't really strike me as kind of a particularly reliable bunch. And I thought, really, they've kind of done well to still be in the relegation scrap now rather than having already gone down. I mean, am I wrong on this?
No, I mean, look at the squad. It's certainly not the best in the league, is it? And QPR have been relegated with better players, I'd say, already.
Other than Burnley, no, I don't think anybody has worse players than...
It's a better squad than Leicester.
I thought, you know, they spent...
Leicester have king power, though.
True, best did.
They spent a fair bit of money, didn't they, in the
summer? Yeah,
I didn't think they'd be... I think, having stayed up last season, I thought they would progress. I think the difficulty that they've had is marrying the spirit that took them up and the players that took them up, and then the people that they brought in. And I think I went down to do an interview, you know, three or four weeks ago, and there's a very close knit feeling in the training ground. And I know that can be deceptive just on a day there, but I know Steve Harper well, and he says that there's nothing like the kind of toxic feeling that there was at Newcastle when they went down in 2009, which obviously he was there and around. I think that's been the balancing act, but it just hasn't sparked on the pitch. I think there's an okay feeling around the place. It just hasn't sparked. I don't think they have actually played to their potential.
Of the three, who's going down?
Hull.
All right. Free and easy. Right, the other thing was just... I was watching Match of Day 2 last night, and I'm not going to have... you're not going to mock him, but he did throw something out there, which I thought might be fun debating, and I put this out on Twitter, and people enjoyed it. But basically, it was in the context of Phil Jones... And at one point, Phil Neville kind of blurts out the fact that centre-back is the easiest position to play.
Sometimes I wonder when I listen to Phil Neville if he's ever played football, ever, even in the park or something. Because I think he took so much...
Okay, which is not a discussion on Phil Neville.
But, and just Phil, if you listen to us, for me, the easiest position is probably right-back, where you and your bruv played, but definitely not centre-half.
The game's all in front of you can see everything, but the saying is for fullback with the added advantage is
you can look across the line.
You can look across the line, you've got someone in front of you.
Yeah, and you've got the centre back who's covering behind you, you know.
You don't have to head the ball.
Exactly.
You're rarely exposed one on one. So yeah, the fullbacks is, I would say, the easiest position, which is why that wingers take to it later in their careers, centre backs that aren't great in the air. I was amazed that no one challenged him.
Well, what is the easiest position on the pitch, Matt?
Probably right back, given most people are right footed.
Everybody can play there. Everybody can play there.
Time for some quick hits. Jake Livermore tested positive for cocaine last week. Matt, what's an appropriate punishment, if at all, given that it's a recreational drug?
Well, he'll definitely be punished because he's in breach of contract, so technically he could be sacked, I suppose.
You can be in breach of contract for talking to the media,
Chelsea
too.
Chelsea did with me, too. The FA, I guess they'll do him for bringing misconduct, disrepute. I imagine they'll get a six-game ban, which seems reasonable.
Sunderland keep another clean sheet, and looks like the great escape is almost complete. George, how much of the credit goes to Dick Advocaat?
Yeah, we have to say almost at this point. Yeah, a lot of it does, actually. He stripped things back, kept things very simple, got them doing the basics. He's had that luxury in the sense that he hasn't had to look at structure, he hasn't had to look at long term, he hasn't had to think about anything other than the those, you know, those few games that he was given, but he's done very well.
Sadio Mane breaks Robbie Fowler's record and bags the quickest hat trick in Premier League history as Southampton romp past Villa 6-1. Julian, what's your realistic goal for Southampton next season?
Just try to confirm this good season, finishing in the top six again. I don't think they can finish in the top four, but you know, fifth or sixth is, should be the objective if they keep the best player this summer.
Which you presumably won't. Them.
It's going to be difficult. Like that's where they are. They're a feeder club anyway. So, but if they can sign, make a few good, clever signings like they did last summer, you know, top six could be the, should be the object.
Jose Mourinho is supposedly miffed that he didn't win Manager of the Month at all this season. Does this mean he won't win Manager of the Year? And should he?
Well, it's picked by different people, so they're not necessarily correlated. But I don't think he will win it. And maybe he shouldn't. If you just won it, if you just gave it to the manager who won the league, then what would be the point of the award? It's an award that is subjective and adds value for individual achievements. So I'd like someone like Koeman or Gary Monk, I guess, should probably be recognised for their work.
I'm one of the people who votes for Manager of the Month. And I wish I could just go and just sledgehammer the faces of people who are like, well, how could he never have won the Manager of the Month?
It is weird, though.
It's not weird.
It is weird.
There's nothing weird about it. You reward individual performances by a team in the course of a month relative to their resources. They've been the best team, the most consistent team all year. Doesn't mean that they were the best or most impressive team in any one month.
But is that part of the spec relevant to their resources? Is that...
Yes, that for the same reason you might give it to Gary Monk. Who would you rather have managing your team, Gary Monk or Jose Mourinho?
Jose Mourinho.
Exactly. So Jose Mourinho's a better manager, but does it mean he's more of a suitable candidate for Manager of the Year or Manager of the Month? No.
No, but I think it's weird that he hasn't won it for 9 years.
I think you're weird. Middlesbrough and Norwich will contest the playoffs, which means we could have three teams from the Northeast in the Premier League next year.
You reckon?
No doubt that excites you, George.
For one season.
For one season, yeah.
And then they all go down. No. how do you see it going?
The playoff final, I think it'll be very tight, third and fourth in the division. Norwich obviously had the momentum behind them. I thought Middlesbrough, there was the risk that they might tail off, but I was at the Riverside Stadium on Friday night and they were very, very, very impressive. There's definite belief there. There's momentum there. I think it'll be close, but I do fancy them to sneak it now.
Steven Gerrard played his final game at Anfield, although Crystal Palace and the awful, evil Alan Pardew rather spoiled it by winning 3-1. Julian, in the pantheon of English players, as seen from across La Manche,
Where
does he rank?
Across La Manche, he ranks right there at the top, I think, with the best. I was definitely privileged.
Who's ahead of him? In like the last, in the Premier League era.
In the Premier League era.
As seen from France.
As seen from France.
All Frenchmen. Even the 30 million who hate football and don't understand it.
Yeah, for me, he's the best English players of the Premier League era. You know, better than Alan Shearer, better than...
Come on.
Yeah, sorry. He's just had something, you know, something special that it's just so rare. I think Shearer is a great striker, for example, but there were a lot of great strikers before. There would be a lot of great strikers. But players like Gerrard, I think, is a rarity, and we probably won't see another one like him for another few decades, I think. And it's just, I was privileged to see him play. A lot of people were in this country, which was great. And now I hope that the Americans will realise that they're privileged as well to see an ageing one, but still the real one.
Gab, one for you. What the hell happened between River and Boca last week? And what are the repercussions?
Well, River and Boca, of course, as you know, Matt, is the Super Clásico, one of the most intense rivalries in the world. And on top of playing each other in the league, they were playing each other in Copa Libertadores, which is South American equivalent of the Champions League. It happened at the start of the second half. This was at La Bombonera, Boca's stadium, River Plate. They have sort of this inflatable tunnel that they kind of let the players walk onto the pitch from. Some guy thought it would be hilarious to go and basically cut a hole in the back of the inflatable tunnel, stick a canister of CS spray, pepper spray, mace, effectively in there, and spray the River Plate players, who obviously, two of them, I think, had to be hospitalized and whatever else. Now, it just strikes me that I can't remember somebody attacking players in a premeditated way like this at a football match. I mean, you do this on the street and you go straight to prison. We've seen players sadly being attacked, not that often, but it's spontaneous. It's because something happened. I mean, this is just one of the most disgusting, cowardly things I can think of. Not as bad as spitting, of course, because that's the absolute worst thing you can do. But this is a close second. And so as a result, Boca are have been knocked out of, or they've been suspended from the Copa Libertadores for the next year. And when they return, they won't be able to play home games, apparently, for another season. But to me, it's a criminal act, and one of the worst I've seen. That's all we've got time for this week. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes and Player FM for Android, please do so. Many, many thanks to my guests today, Julian Lawrence, Matt Hughes, and again, George Culkin. It's been an absolute privilege to have you, and it's been fantastic. Also because your presence means that Rory's not here. Check out thetimes.co.uk on your digital device. Members will get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of their subscription. If you're not a member yet, you can take our £1 digital trial today. Just search Times Sport online. Same place, same time next week. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.